Wing TV, with Victor Thorne and Lisa Giuliani. The revolution is being televised.
Hello, it's Friday, June 17th, and you're watching Wing TV. I'm Lisa Giuliani.
And I'm Victor Thorne. Welcome to Wing TV. We have a very special guest on today, Mr. Michael Collins Piper. But first, we have to announce that next Saturday, Lisa and myself are going to be speaking at the America First Party of Pennsylvania. We're going to give a speech on the New World Order and the control of the electoral process. Mm-hmm. So we'll give you more details about that as time goes on. Now, Mr. Michael Collins Piper, we can say with a great deal of certainty that, in our opinion, he's the best political writer in the country.
We love him.
Right. As many of you know, he writes for the American Free Press.
Our favorite newspaper.
Right. He's also the author of Final Judgment, which is going to be in print again here within the next few days, I think. Also, The High Priests of War, which came out last year. And also his most recent book, The New Jerusalem, which we're going to be talking about today. He also was very instrumental in this special edition of the American Free Press. It was called Uncovering the OKC Cover-Up.
Right.
And right before I was done finishing this book, The OKC Bombing Elohim City Connection, I gave Michael a call. And he was the one that really tied up all the loose ends that I was unsure about, and I quoted him quite extensively in that book.
Michael Collins Piper is a vault of information.
He certainly is. So, Michael, welcome to Wing TV.
Hey, it's good to be back on the show.
Hi, Michael. Yeah.
And hey, I want to say, Victor and Lisa, your book on the Oklahoma City bombing, as far as I'm concerned, is probably the only published item anywhere that really hits directly where the things need to be hit.
Well, thank you.
You know, there's a lot of information out there about the Oklahoma City bombing, and I think that as we have seen in the JFK assassination and in 9/11 and everything, there's a lot of creative conspiracy theories and a variety of opinions, but they all seem to never quite hit the target.
Yeah, well, I know.
And
that
so that's why I was glad when you put that out. I think it ties things together pretty well there.
And I tapped into a lot of your information. So let's jump into this book now. I got the New Jerusalem a few weeks ago, and it's phenomenal. We couldn't wait to interview you today. So to start off, I think the most vital point that every person in this country needs to know is found right on page one of the introduction to this book, where you say the two great tragedies of this still young century are 9/11, of course, and also the American invasion of Iraq, which was a direct consequence of U.S. policy in the Middle East, which is dictated by the Israeli lobby. So my first question, Michael, is, tell us why it's so vitally important to understand this fundamental notion.
I'm sorry?
Oh, well, tell us why...
I think I lost you there for a second. You asked me to explain the fundamental notion that...
Yeah, well, tell us why it's so fundamental to know...
Well, that's very simple, Victor. You know, as you point out, I point out in the book there that, you know, here we are, we're involved in this bloody, insane, nonsensical war in Iraq that is only making the United States enemies throughout the Middle East but around the world. And we had 3,000 Americans victims of a terrorist tragedy that has been attributed to Middle Eastern terrorists. Now, frankly, I have very serious questions about who ultimately was responsible for 9/11, but just for the sake of argument, let's accept the president's claim that we were attacked by angry Muslims from the Middle East. Okay, here are the two. In my lifetime, there have been two things that I have desperately fought against since I was old enough to think anything politically. Number one, U.S. involvement in a war, particularly in the Middle East. I saw what happened in Vietnam, and I saw no reason, again, for anybody to ever have to be subjected to the brutality of war.
Right.
It affected my own brother. He was a Vietnam veteran, and he never completely got over Vietnam. Okay. Then the other thing that I was very concerned about was a terrorist attack in the United States, and lo and behold, we finally had one. So, you know, and it's all because, I'm sorry to say, Israel. It has nothing to do with oil. It's all about Israel. It's about the fact that we have a very powerful lobby in this country, whether you want to call it the Israeli lobby or the pro-Israel lobby or the Jewish lobby, mm-hmm. whatever you want to call it. The fact is that it exists. It's not a conspiracy theory. Some people say that's a conspiracy theory or an old canard or an old wives' tale based on the protocols of the learned elders of Zion, which they say is a forgery. Well, okay.
Michael.
It's not. It's not a wives' tale. We have this powerful Israeli lobby, and the people who finance the Israeli lobby are a very, very highly wealthy, highly influential group of people who do happen to be Jewish, and they have accumulated this power and this wealth, and, you know, it's now we are in a position where we effectively have an elite few who can dictate our foreign policy, and it's a foreign policy designed to advance the interests of another country.
Right.
I find that extraordinary.
Let's get back to OKC for a minute. Recently, we attended the OKC bombing's 10-year anniversary, Day of Truth, in Oklahoma City, as well as along with your colleague, Pat Shannon, from the American Free Press.
Mm-hmm.
And in your book, you point out how dozens of well-known public figures from all walks of life have been labeled anti-Semitic. Well, subsequent to our return from Oklahoma City, we've now discovered that the ADL has listed that event, the Day of Truth, on their website, Hate List. Would you like to explain how the ADL acts as the thought police for the Zionist elite in America?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question, and the question is posed in a very revealing context. I was aware that the ADL had, in fact, labeled that meeting a hate or extremist mm-hmm. type event, and I find that extraordinary in itself because I don't think that there was anybody there at that event. Of course, I wasn't there, but I don't think the intent was not to defame any group of people, and that's the Anti-Defamation League claims that it's trying to prevent defamation, group mm-hmm. defamation. I think what that event was just a group of sincere people who were trying to get to the bottom and really find out who murdered all those people in Oklahoma City. And obviously we know that the official government story just doesn't hold up. So I find it very interesting that the Anti-Defamation League would position itself as effectively as a defender of the government. Actually, what the Anti-Defamation League is, it has an interesting history. It started off... because there were so many, and I'm sorry to say this, there were so many Jewish people involved in criminal activity in New York City back in the late 19th century, people started making unkind remarks about Jews, and that's why they started the Anti-Defamation League to kind of counteract mm-hmm. that, because there were so many complaints by the public officials and law enforcement. Well, over the years, the Anti-Defamation League evolved into a very effective conduit and propaganda arm for the State of Israel after it was established. And the ADL, of course, spies, literally spies, on thousands and thousands of Americans. The FBI and even the FBI and the San Francisco Police Department conducted an extensive investigation in the ADL spying activities and discovered they had files on thousands of Americans, and not just people on the right wing. A lot of folks who consider themselves liberal thought the ADL was just out there spying on those evil Klansmen and Nazis, and it turned out they were spying on all sorts of people of all political stripes.
Well, Mike,
so basically, the ADL is a thought police. It is designed to prevent anyone from saying anything critical about the State of Israel, unless it's approved by the ADL in advance, essentially. And anyone who dares to mention the fact that, for example, that the Israelis have an immense power in this country, they're considered, the Israeli lobby, they're considered anti-Semitic. So that's what the ADL is. It is a thought police.
Now, in your book, Final Judgment, you reveal that there was an obvious tension between John Kennedy and David Ben-Gurion, and also everybody knows how Richard Nixon felt about the Jews. But in your new book, you also bring up revelations about Harry Truman, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, even James Baker, mm-hmm. their feelings on the Jewish lobby. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I can tell you one thing, that all of those people you've mentioned have been quoted in mainstream sources as using some pretty foul language, which I wouldn't want to say on your show, in reference to the power of the Jewish people in America vis-a-vis their influence, particularly on U.S. foreign policy. Harry Truman, in the book, you know, they discovered his private diaries. Now, this is the guy who, this is the guy who is basically a hero of the Jewish people for his role in helping bring about the founding of the State of Israel, and how, of course, he recognized the State of Israel, and just he's always been a hero. But in his private diary, which was cited on the in a Washington Post, I'm going to read this quote. This is what Harry Truman, former President Harry Truman, said in his diary entry of July 21st, 1947. He says, "The Jews have no sense of proportion, nor do they have any judgment on world affairs. The Jews, I find, are very, very selfish. They care not how many Estonians, Latvians, Finns, Poles, Yugoslavs, or Greeks get murdered or mistreated as displaced persons, as long as the Jews get special treatment. Yet when they, the Jews that is, have power, physical, financial, or political, neither Hitler nor Stalin has anything on them for cruelty or mistreatment to the underdog." Now, that's a pretty strong statement.
Yeah, I'd say.
Very. And that's right at the end of the book.
It's certainly stronger than anything I have ever said, or any, or a lot of people have ever said.
Yeah.
But I want to tell you something. Based upon my study of history, and I'm standing in my library, I have, just in this room alone, I probably have about 6,000 books.
Wow.
I'm pretty well read. I would have to say that, based upon my reading, what Harry Truman said is exactly true, and this is what we're finding now. We are finding that the ruling Jewish elites in America, and I'm not talking about every Jewish person now. I have Jewish friends who are just as down-to-earth and as, you know, normal human beings as any of us are. I'm talking about these big, powerful Jewish elites with literally billions of dollars in their control, and who are using that influence because of their desire to advance the State of Israel. Okay, these people, they do not care how many American kids get butchered in Iraq. They do not care, you know, this is absolutely of no concern to them. They're fully ready to get us into a war against Iran, against Syria, and I predict ultimately they're going to try to figure out a way to invade Saudi Arabia. And that's probably just the beginning, you know. So,
yeah.
So these people are truly bloodthirsty in the sense that maybe bloodthirsty is not the word. It's just that they don't care,
right?
And they know that American kids will be their cannon fodder, and their kids won't be.
Okay, you've quoted Benjamin Ginsberg's book, The Fatal Embrace, and in it he says 3/4 of America's foreign aid budget is dedicated to Israel's security interests. So, Michael, do you think this figure would be shocking to most Americans?
You know, that's funny. That's an interesting point. Most people, the quick answer to that is yes. Because most people think of foreign aid in kind of, there, a lot of people just don't like it, period. And those who do like foreign aid, they think of it as going, you know, helping the starving kids in Ethiopia. You know, they think, you know, they have this, you know, kind of heartfelt, very fond, sentimental idea that, oh, we're a nice, rich, powerful country here in the United States, and we give our money to starving people abroad. Well, that isn't where we give the money to. Most of our foreign aid goes to Israel, and a substantial portion goes to Egypt to pay Egypt to be nice to Israel. And Israel, the people of Israel, have, as I understand it, one of the highest per capita levels of income,
right,
vis-a-vis the rest of the world. You know, that because, and it's precisely because of the United States propping up the State of Israel.
Oh, yeah.
That's a very, very wealthy little country only because the United States props it up. We hear all about the wonders of Israeli technology and Israeli science and Israeli this and Israeli that. It only exists because the United States puts the money in there.
Oh,
so it's not like this country. I mean, any other country in the world of the same size could accomplish the same things with the United States propping up. Israel is essentially a beggar state.
Yeah,
it could not exist without the United States, and yet the United States' entire foreign policy at this time, whether it be in the Middle East or anywhere in the world, is predicated predicated on what is necessary for Israel's best interest.
That's right. Right. Now, we recently watched a videotape that confirms a lot of the stuff that you said in this book, where this videotape took a historic look at the Jewish people and the state. And basically what it says is everywhere that the Jewish people have been throughout history, one of three things has happened. They've either been enslaved, they've been driven out, or they've been killed en masse. So what do you attribute this to? And also, has there ever been another people in history that has been experienced
well,
the same phenomenon?
Let me tell you what I told a Jewish friend of mine. You know, I said to him, I look at your newspapers, Jewish community newspapers, and most of the content of the newspapers is about who the Jews don't like and who the Jews think don't like them.
Yep.
Now, you know, I'm not of Polish descent, but I used to have a subscription. It was sent to me of a Polish community magazine, you know, and I've seen lots of other, you know, ethnic community magazines, because we had an editor in our old newspaper, the Spotlight, who had a lot of friends from Eastern Europe, so we got a lot of ethnic community publications, and they were all those publications were very positive, very forward-looking. You know, they'd have nice articles about the homeland, you know, and articles about the community events and, you know, commemorating some famous Polish American or some famous Italian American or, you know, Slavic American or what have you, you know. But you read the Jewish newspapers and it's a panorama of anger and hatred for everybody, constantly complaining. So if this is how the Jews act and think as a group, and that's what community newspapers reflect. They reflect group think, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
If this is how they're acting in the United States today, where they've got more power and influence than they've ever had, than in any other country in the world, even including Israel, for that matter.
Right.
So I wonder how they were acting in the old days when they were getting kicked out of all these countries.
God only knows.
I mean, you know, really, there's no other... I mean, you know, all groups at one time or another have somebody who doesn't like them. You know, but for some reason throughout history, the Jewish people have been kicked, out of every European country.
Right. Okay, Michael, there's a new wave among the Zionist media elite, people like William Kristol, where they're setting a tone that if you're critical of Israel, you're not only anti-Semitic, but you're also anti-American and anti-Christian. Would you comment briefly on this, please?
Well, that's, of course, absolute nonsense. I mean, this is the real propaganda line that they're trying to put out now, that anyone, as you say, anyone who is anti-Israel is therefore anti-American. Now, that's an extraordinary claim, you know, and also, as you say, they're also saying that if you're anti-Israel, you're therefore automatically anti-Christian.
Mm,
well,
right.
That's going to come as a big surprise to many of the Christian pastors, I know.
I don't think so.
Who are critical of Israel. But, you know, as Harry Truman said, they have no sense of proportion, and, you know, these people will lie and tell the biggest lies and expect people to believe them. And, I mean, you know, as I always say, as far as U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East is concerned, it's a tissue of lies backed up by bullying and brute force, and lots of double standards to boot. So, you know, this is if we see this in our U.S. Middle East policy, we'll find this in every facet of this influence of these hardline Zionists and their shills in the media.
Now, Deep Throat has been in the news of late for the last few weeks, and it's been revealed that it's Mark Felt. Now, of course, one of the people that confirmed this is Bob Woodward, who has a tendency to only let this information out when the person isn't able to confirm it. A good example was when he interviewed William Casey on his deathbed. Now, Mark Felt's 91 years old. He can't really confirm a lot of this. So what's your take on Deep Throat? And also, your take on how he was a heavy smoker, which Mark Felt wasn't. Also, how Deep Throat was very literate, which Mark Felt wasn't, and also James Jesus Angleton.
Well, first of all, as far as Mark Felt is concerned, I don't necessarily buy the idea that he so to speak. There were, and there have been others who have been writing on this, and they feel pretty strongly that it's safe to suspect that there were other sources, but for whatever reason, and while Mark Felt may have been one of the primary sources, he probably was not just acting as a how should we say a lone angel. You know, he's being portrayed as a hero of sorts. He probably was working for somebody else behind the scenes, and ironically, as I understand it, I'm still looking into this, but it's very, very likely that Mark Felt would have probably had connections to James Angleton, who you were referring to earlier. You know, Felt was involved in the COINTEL program.
Yeah.
COINTELPRO program. Mm-hmm. That was the secret FBI infiltration of and disruption of political groups. Well, James Angleton at the CIA was running his own operation, Chaos, and which was a similar thing, and again, totally illegal because the CIA was not supposed to be operating on American soil.
That's right.
Well, James Angleton's deputy in that program was a guy named Richard Ober, and mm-hmm. Deborah Davis, in her book on Catherine Graham of the Washington Post, her book titled Catherine the Great, she makes a very strong case that this Richard Ober would have been, and was, in her opinion, Deep Throat. And as I say, that ties directly back to Mark Felt, because Felt and Ober were both running related operations. And, of course, Ober was the deputy of James Angleton. Now, Angleton, this is where my take in Final Judgment is, that Angleton was a known heavy smoker, a chain smoker, notorious chain smoker. And also, by the time he died, a raving alcoholic. I mean, he was quite delusional. And, of course, Bob Woodward and Bernstein, in their book, All the President's Men, described Deep Throat as having been a heavy smoker and drinker. Now, that description does not fit Mark Felt.
Right.
So why they chose to use that description, I think, is of interest, because if they were lying about Deep Throat and trying to cover up, I find it interesting that they would have given a description which sounded an awful lot like James Angleton.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, Michael, there's a report out yesterday about the GOP dream ticket for 2008 featuring John McCain and Jeb Bush. We don't know how plausible this is, but would you give us a little behind-the-scenes tie in the McCain family to organized crime figure Jim Hensley and the Bronfman family, who are prominent figures in the World Jewish Congress?
Yeah, that is an interesting story. And, you know, when I've told people who like John McCain about this, they just want to not believe it, or they try to explain it away. But
right.
here's what the situation is. John McCain's wife, I believe her name is Cindy. She is the daughter of a rather interesting figure named Jim Hensley. Well, Jim Hensley went to jail some years ago. I believe he's dead now, but he went to jail some years ago. He took the fall for his boss, who was a guy named Kemper Marley. Well, Kemper Marley was the guy who ran the state of Arizona, both the Democratic and Republican parties. And as powerful as Kemper Marley was, Kemper Marley was actually basically the front man for the Bronfman family of Canada. Now, that's extraordinary when you think that a family operating in Canada basically was running a U.S. state. Well, actually, it may not be as extraordinary, because if you consider the fact that Arizona, even now, has a relatively small population.
Yeah.
He's a big state, but has a very small population. You know, if you set your operations up in place, you know, you're very well positioned to run, to be able to do something like that. Well, that's exactly what the Bronfman family did. You know, of course, it was close to Arizona, or close to Nevada. And, of course, Nevada was an outpost of the gambling
right.
syndicate, and the Bronfmans were very much tied up with the Meyer-Lansky crime syndicate. So it was all, you know, all interconnected there.
Pretty cozy.
And Jim Hensley, as I say, Jim Hensley, who was John McCain's father-in-law, was a key figure in this criminal enterprise that ran the state. state of Arizona. Now, what's interesting about that is his reward for taking the rap for Kemper Marley was to get a major Budweiser beer distributorship that was given to him, and that made him a very wealthy man, and now, of course, it has made John McCain a very wealthy man.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, luckily, not all the world leaders are under the sway of the Zionists. Two good examples would be Hugo Chavez down in Venezuela, and also the Malaysian Prime Minister Muhammad. So, do you think that others are going to follow this lead, especially when there was a recent meeting that was blacked out, basically, in the United States, when there was representatives from 12 South American countries plus 22 Arab nations?
I'm not sure. This meeting you're talking about, where was this?
I just read it the other day, but they said there was 12 South American countries represented.
Oh, yes, okay, I'm sorry. I know exactly what you're referring to. Yes, it's very, very interesting, yes. Yeah, what is happening, you know, in South America, these countries are just as, everybody's fed up with the power of Israel,
mm-hmm.
and attributes it to the United States letting Israel get away with anything, mm-hmm. So what is happening is that there are more and more people, more and more countries, that do feel very free to speak out about Zionist power in America. And like you cited, Hugo Chavez of Venezuela, even Vladimir Putin of Russia, he has not been so outspoken per se. You do find that the Zionist lobby here in America does not really trust or care for Putin.
Yeah.
And if they could overthrow Putin and install someone to their liking, they would. So yes, you do find this very serious expressions of disregard, so to speak,
for the power of
Zionism, and I think it's bad for America because you know we're attaching ourselves to an entity that the people of the world have very little regard for.
Right.
I'd like your opinion on the recent French and Dutch no votes to the EU charter.
Wait, I'm sorry, say that again.
I'd like to know what you think about the recent French and Dutch no votes on the EU charter.
Oh, interesting. You know, I'll tell you, I they used to say nationalism was bad,
mm-hmm.
that it was old-fashioned, that it was... And that it was dead. Well, I think what you're seeing now, again, these are expressions of nationalism. People want to maintain the integrity of their own countries, ethnic groups. You know, there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I mean, you know, they've always tried to tell us, that we should all, mingle and intermarry and abandon our traditions and. You know, well, nothing wrong with commemorating and preserving your nation and your ethnicity, and you know that's essentially what you're seeing an expression of, I would say, in that vote against the EU. I mean, I know a lot of people who think the European Union is a good idea. I also know a lot of people who think it's a very bad idea.
You think it's a bad
and frankly,
idea?
I'm not sure myself. I don't really have a firm opinion on it because, as I say, I've heard so many good arguments from both sides. But the bottom line is that Dutch vote is an expression of nationalism.
That's right. Now, let's look forward to the 2008 election. Hillary Clinton, do you think she's going to land the Democratic nomination? And do you think there's any possibility that she's going to end up in the White House again?
That's an interesting question, and I'll tell you why it's a really interesting question. It's the fact that there's a book that's supposed to be coming out on Hillary Clinton.
Ed Klein, yeah.
Yeah, and he's a writer for Parade magazine, which is owned by the Newhouse family,
right.
One of the big, powerful Jewish publishing empires. They own the Harrisburg Patriot, among other newspapers, but... But in any case, this new book that about Hillary, I actually have a copy of the Vanity Fair article.
Okay.
That's talking, which is an excerpt from this book, and in big bold letters, highlighted in the middle of the page, they have a quote from Senator Pat Moynihan's wife, Liz, speaking to Hillary Clinton. "The reason you're not doing well in New York," said Liz Moynihan, "is because Jews don't like you." Now this is something. This is how people really, powerful political people really do talk. I know that sounds very shocking to many of your listeners, but real power politics stock right there. Yeah. And that's what Mrs. Moynihan told Hillary. Now, this is what's interesting. The fact is that there have been a lot of allegations. There are suspicions of Hillary Clinton within the Jewish community. The average American would think that Hillary is a big favorite of the Jews. In fact, when she ran for the Senate in New York and won, she only won 55% of the Jewish vote.
Huh.
Considering the fact that Al Gore, running on that same ticket that same year, won 80% of the Jewish vote, I think that indicates that there is a little bit of concern about Hillary. There have been allegations also that that she has been very privately quite anti-Semitic in her tone, and as a college student at the time, she mixed up with Bill Clinton. It's been written in one book that I have here in this library. She was known to be a very, very strong critic of Israel, a strong supporter of the Palestinians, and had a lot of disregard for U.S. policy in the Middle East. So as I say, I don't think that Hillary Clinton will be, let's put it this way, I don't think if the Jewish people have the ultimate power in selecting the Democratic nominee, which of course they won't, but they have a great deal of power there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think they'll take Hillary on. I think there's enough suspicion of Hillary among the Jewish power elite that I think they'll do everything they can to stop her, frankly.
Yeah. Well, Michael, before we go out, I want to remind everyone the new book is called The New Jerusalem. Go to the American Free Press website. All the information can be found there. And, Michael, one last question. Everyone keeps waiting for what they think is going to be the next spike event. Well, we see over in Europe that the EU charter is going down the drain. We see that war support in this country is going down the drain. We see a lot of resistance to this new CAFTA treaty. We see that George Bush's Social Security privatization scam is going down the drains. The neocons haven't been able to conquer the Middle East. And finally, there's this new Downing memo, and plus the heat is still on about 9/11. So do you think that a spike event, something similar to 9/11, is on the horizon in the near future?
That's a very scary question, Victor. I have this concern about the fact that these power elites, you know, when they start to lose their grasp, they always need something to, I don't know, I'm mixing metaphors here, but they need something to recharge your engines.
Yeah.
You know, they need to reestablish themselves, to reassert their authority, and what better way than another terrorist attack?
That's right. That's why we see it, because these guys don't like to lose, and it seems like, you know, they're being backed in a corner now, and we just, God forbid, we hope another one doesn't happen. So, Michael,
I mean, we know we've been lied to about 9/11, so who was responsible? I don't really know for certain, but I have a pretty good idea, and I don't think it was Osama bin Laden.
Exactly. Well, Michael, thank you for taking so much time out of your day for
us.
Thank
you, Michael.
I appreciate it. It's always fun. Anytime.
Well, thank you. The book's The New Jerusalem. Get this book, folks. This is as good as it gets out there, and subscribe to the American Free Press. Michael, have a good weekend.
All right, you too, Victor and Lisa.
Bye.
Take care of yourself.
Bye-bye.
All right, folks, we'll be back on Monday. We're going to talk about 9/11 and who knows what else. So keep your eyes open, folks. There's a lot going on.
Have a good weekend.